This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 181.
This podcast is brought to you by the Jabra Sport Pulse wireless earbuds with in-ear heart rate monitor so that you can improve your training. Visit Jabra.com/MTA to get started with the Sport Pulse, and you can also find it at your local Best Buy. Jabra, this is where it starts. This episode is also brought to you by the North Face Endurance Challenge, Utah. Take on a trail running race distance of 5K, 10K, half marathon, marathon relay, marathon, 50K, or 50 miler at the Park City Mountain Resort in Park City, Utah on September 24th to the 25th. No matter if you're a first timer on the trails or an ultra veteran, this event offers something for everyone, and listeners to this podcast can get 15% off their entry fees when you use the discount code MTA15 at checkout. That's MTA15. Hello and welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where it's all about empowering you to run a marathon and change your life. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we speak with scientist and author Wendy Suzuki about how running changes the brain. Plus, we'll give you an update about our epic summer vacation. That was Angie saying, huh? And, of course, to get expert help in your training, connect with us at marathontrainingacademy.com, where you can find out about Academy membership and our awesome online community. Well, folks, we apologize for any extra noises that might be picked up on our microphone, because we are sitting in a campground in California, not far from Yosemite National Park. And it's amazing that Angie's even doing this, because she ran a 50K, 31 miles today.
I told him we had to sit down and record quickly before my brain goes to sleep.
Well, you're looking good for having run that far today. How you feeling?
I feel like I ran 31 miles. We'll just leave it at that.
So she did a trail ultra marathon. It was called the Shadow of the Giants 50K, and is a very unique, interesting, maybe even bizarre race. We'll tell you all about it on our next episode, episode 182. We're really excited about this one. You're going to love our interview with Wendy Suzuki. She is author of the book Healthy Brain, Happy Life, and she's been studying the effect of exercise on the brain. We're going to talk about brain plasticity and all kinds of good stuff. I know you're going to love it. And before we get any further, though, we want to make a couple shout-outs to folks in the community who are doing some awesome things, just to say congrats and let everybody know what's possible.
That's right. I'd like to say congratulations to Doug, who finished his first half marathon, and he's building up to a full marathon. Also, congratulations to Academy member Naomi, who got a 4-minute PR at the Rock and Roll San Diego Half Marathon. She posted in the group, "It was my first time racing for a time goal in over 2 years after battling many nagging injuries, and it felt great to be back, a true blessing. I stuck with my race plan and stayed mentally strong to the finish, which is a huge improvement for me. My super speedy husband also finished with a PR of 1 hour and 34 minutes.
Well, congrats, Naomi, on that PR, and I like what she said about sticking with her plan and staying mentally strong. You know, if you've had a race where you felt like your mental game kind of fell apart, that could be a good goal for next time, and even something to concentrate on during your training.
Exactly, and that's a lot of what we talk about in this episode.
Yes.
How to keep that mental game strong. This next note is from Bradley in the Academy. He says, "A new PB, 1 hour, 43 minutes, and 37 seconds at the Barossa Half Marathon in South Australia. This was my goal race for this preparation. Pre-race, I dealt with some gastro issues and infected sinuses all week. It was the hardest half I've ever run, but all worth it."
Yeah, well, that's great. Thank you for sharing that, Bradley. And, you know, it goes to show you that sometimes the week before a marathon, like, everything can start going wrong. Stomach pain, gastro issues, whatever. But you can still get out there and push through and have a great time.
That's right. This next note comes from Judith in Norway, and she's telling us about her first marathon. She says, "At first I was nervous, alone, and a little bit excited and scared when I entered the bus in the morning. It was about 3 degrees Celsius and gray outside, and at one point during the race it poured down rain. My strategy was to focus on getting to the top of the mountain during this hilly race, and I used my daughter's traits as my strength and motivation for the tough spots. This really helped, along with using some mantras like, I have what it takes to run a marathon and change my life. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Another one she used was Enjoy from Dan, another Academy member, and Run Smart from Angie. I'm so grateful to be part of this community. I finished in 4 hours, 34 minutes, and it was a fantastic day, one I'll never forget.
Well, thank you so much, Judith, for sharing. And again, that just highlights the importance of having a mantra and what you tell yourself when you're out there. And it goes along perfectly. I don't know if you chose that on purpose, Angie, because it goes perfectly, again, with our interview.
No, it just happened to be one of the ones that I wanted to highlight today. So, yeah. This next note comes from Academy member Sherry. She says, hello, my friends and support group. I also ran Mountains to Beach Marathon yesterday and PR'd. I did not expect this since I've been battling a hip injury for the last 3 months, but what a thrill. I ran a 4:15, beating my last PR by 4 minutes. My BQ time is 4:10, so I'm pretty close. It was a great course and certainly a place where BQs are made. I wanted to give a shout out to my 80-year-old dad who ran the Coeur d'Alene Marathon yesterday, too. He did great. He has run over 200 marathons and ultras, and I'm so proud of him.
Wow.
I have gained so much from this MTA group of people and Angie and Trevor. You guys have made a huge difference in my life. Thanks for all you do. I'm a better person because of this group.
Well, thank you so much, Sherry. That definitely is what we love to hear. That's why we started MTA, and that's why we do this. And it sounds like your dad is just totally awesome. I mean, 80 years old, still out there kicking butt. That's how I want to be.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. That's how I want to be when I grow up.
You grow up. That's great. Maybe he doesn't feel old. That's the thing, is some octogenarians, the ones that are, you know, healthy environment, they don't see themselves as old.
Right, all about mindset again, huh? This next note comes from Academy member Jyotsna. She says, I ran my second marathon yesterday at Mountain to Beach and ended up with a PR and a BQ. I followed the 3:30 plan and finished in 3:35:05. I needed 3:40 for my BQ age group. I started the race wearing headphones and very quickly took them off. I felt like the music was throwing my heart rate off. And I told myself, if Angie doesn't run with music, it's probably not important. Smart woman. At mile 22, I felt like I was going to lose a toenail, and I was thinking of Angie talking about her toenails falling off all the time, and it's no big deal. I read all the tips posted in the Academy the night before and made sure I fueled and hydrated well. I'm so happy to have found this podcast and become a member. You guys are amazing. Thanks for helping make my dream come true.
Wow, amazing shout-outs today. Thank you so much for that message. And maybe we'll start a new hashtag, WWAD, what would Angie do? Because, Angie, you are a exemplary person in so many ways.
Well, when we start updating people on our trip later, they may not want to be like me.
Sometimes you don't have the most patience with lovable husbands.
Lovable ones, huh?
Yeah, that's great. Though she referred to using our 3:30 plan, which is the plan that we sell on our website, but something that you can get as a member if you've ever thought about just joining up with us and becoming a member of the Academy. We have all of our training plans and more that you can have full access to as long as you stay a member. But it's awesome to see people just taking the information that we provide and going out and taking action on it and seeing great success. So that's awesome.
That's right. And this final note comes from Academy member Abigail. She says, I finished my first 50K yesterday. It was an amazing, inspirational, and at many points, quite humbling experience. I used the MTA 50K training plan and was grateful for all the emphasis on cross training. However, I should probably have focused on running up and down stairs more to take on this incredibly challenging course. But I was able to meet my A goal of finishing in less than 7 hours, just 13 days after a marathon. I know I don't post much, but I gained so much inspiration from this group. I'm continually able to re-examine what is possible and move the bar higher. And now to find the next trail race to sign up for.
Well, that's the best way to finish, is finishing happy enough to look for another one. So we're glad to hear that you are continually rethinking what is possible. And I think life should be all about that.
That's right.
We just want to say congrats to all of you out there who are becoming a better version of yourself. And we know you're going to love this interview with Dr. Wendy Suzuki. You know, we talked to her through Skype, and so we had the advantage of talking to her through the video Skype. And she was sitting in her office, and just to describe, like, her office was so full of color. And in the beginning of this interview, she talks about research that was done with rats who were in this sensory-deprived environment versus ones that were in an environment full of color and how their brains differed. So I thought about our personal spaces, our offices, the rooms in our house, our kids' bedrooms. You know, how stimulating are they?
I feel like this camper is a bit of a sensory deprivation.
Well, it's kind of hard to hang things on the wall. Everything shakes. It's actually not too bad. I've seen campers with the furniture is like really flowery and not really our style.
This one's very neutral.
Yes. Anyway, Angie doesn't have much good to say about the camper.
Back to the interview.
We'll tell you all about it at the end of the interview here. Let's go ahead and play that for you right now. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. All right, we're on the podcast now with Wendy Suzuki. She has a PhD in neuroscience and is a researcher at New York University, and she's the author of the book, Healthy Brain, Happy Life. Wendy, welcome to the MTA podcast.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So what got you interested in studying the brain?
Well, there was actually a moment that I could go back to that made me realize I wanted to be a neuroscientist. And it happened to be the very first day of my freshman year at UC Berkeley, where I took one of those freshman seminar classes with just 15 students and a full professor talking. And the one I chose was called The Brain and Its Potential. And it was taught by this amazing professor, Marion Diamond. And I'll never forget that day because she was very memorable. She was very tall, very beautiful woman, and she was wearing this crisp, light white lab coat over her outfit. And she kind of looked like a science rock star. I mean, she knew what she was doing up there. And so that was memorable. But the other memorable thing is that she had a flowered hat box on the table in front of her. And as she started to tell us about the brain and how amazing it is, and how, in fact, it's the most complex structure known to mankind. I mean, that's just, we all have one. It's right here in our heads, and it is the most complex structure known to mankind. As she was telling us all this, she slowly, with her gloved hands, opened the hat box, and she pulled out a real preserved human brain. And so, of course, we all freshmen went, wow, so cool. But it was actually not just that, seeing the human brain for the first time, which is striking to anybody, you know, seeing it for the first time. But it was really when she told us that same day about the studies, the classic studies that she had done in the 1960s, looking at the effects of raising rats in what she called enriched environments with lots of other rats to play with, lots of toys. And she compared the brains of those rats to rats that were raised in what she called impoverished environments. Hmm. And hers were the first studies to show that in adults, you could actually see changes in the brain. The outer covering of the brain, the cortex, actually grew in size. She was an anatomist and she could measure that.
Wow.
And getting back to the theme of this podcast, we now know that those brains changed because the rats were running more. They had more exercise. They were running around playing with the other rats, and the poor rats in isolation in the impoverished environments, they were just sitting around because there was nothing to do. So I learned that the very first day of my freshman year. It's like, Okay, I want to be a neuroscientist. I want to study the brain. And so it was the brain ever since then.
Well, I have to say, I was just telling Trevor about an interview I watched with you, a live interview, where you brought a human brain in a hat box, and you were pointing out various structures like the hippocampus and things like that. And I was just telling him how fascinating that was.
Yeah, it is. So, you know, I have borrowed from my mentor this approach that is just so engaging because people haven't seen the human brain. They don't, they've heard about it. They see pictures, you know, MRI images, but to actually see one, and I often bring lots of extra gloves so people can actually hold it themselves.
That would be awesome.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Do you happen to have one around your office somewhere?
It's in the other room. You should have told me to bring it.
Too bad this is an audio podcast.
Huh? Okay. Sorry.
It is fascinating. And you were talking about the structure that you are particularly interested in, which is the hippocampus. Tell us a bit about that area and what it's responsible for.
Yeah. So the hippocampus means seahorse. And actually, if you dissect it out, it does look like a seahorse. We all have two hippocampi, one on the right, one on the left. It's buried deep in the brain's temporal lobe. And we've known for a long time that if you damage this structure in people, you are no longer able to form new long-term memories for facts and events. It's devastating. This is the real definition of amnesia. So amnesia, you don't forget growing up and your parents and your friends. What you are no longer able to do is put anything that happens in your life into your long-term memory. And that's actually devastating. Imagine, you know, would you be the same person if you didn't have the memories for the last 5 years?
Yeah.
You would not. And that's what happens to these poor people that have hippocampal damage. They can no longer kind of add to their personal histories. Hmm. And that's also one of the reasons why when I got to the point where I wanted to decide what to study, I wanted to study something in the realm of brain plasticity, how the brain can change.
Yeah.
And memory is one of the most common things that changes in our brains every single day. Everybody learns and remembers something new every day. And that's what I wanted to study.
So explain the concept of neuroplasticity for our listeners. Maybe they've never heard of this concept before.
Yeah. So neuroplasticity is basically the idea that the brain, we know that the brain can change in response to the environment. And so Marion Diamond's studies, my professor at UC Berkeley, showed that if you basically raise rats in the Disney world of environments, their brain changes extensively. But we now know that subtle things like learning a new association, learning something new, learning somebody's name that you don't know before, will change very subtle aspects of brains. So brains are made up of two types of neurons, cells. Neurons, which are kind of the workhorses, and glia, which are kind of support cells, but we're now learning how much they do in support of the neurons. And the neurons have input structures that get information in, and they get information in along these little called spines. And these are the little processes that kind of suck in the information. And learning something new can actually change, allow you to grow more spines. So individual neurons may grow more spines as you're learning something new. So all of that general category of what changes when you run a marathon or you learn the cello, all of that is categorized under brain plasticity.
That's fascinating. So, you know, we're not born with just a finite number of brain cells and then that's it, you're cut off, you know.
Yeah.
The brain has the ability in certain areas especially to
yes.
grow and develop.
Right, right.
Gives us a lot of hope.
Well, it's so individual cells that are there have plasticity. They can change, they can grow, but you know, they could also shrink. There's only two brain areas that we know that can change, you know, where new brain cells can grow when you're an adult. One of them is the hippocampus, which is great for all of us that want better memory. And the other one is the olfactory bulb, important for processing and differentiating between different smells. One of the most exciting things that I tried to highlight in my book is that, okay, so the hippocampus is one area where you can have more brain cells being born. You can do nothing. And as you're growing up, you get more brain cells. But the one thing that we know to speed that process up is aerobic exercise, including running. So for me, that is what gets me out of bed at 5:45 in the morning so I can go work out before I go to work. And that's part of the reason why I want to, you know, spread this information. I think it's a huge motivator. Do you want a better hippocampus? Do you want more cells? Do you want better memory? And usually the answer is overwhelmingly yes. So, you know, aerobic exercise is a way to get to that goal.
So what led you on the journey to make that an emphasis? And what was the story behind the book?
Yeah, so the story behind the book was that, as I say in the introduction, you know, I woke up one day and I realized I really don't have a life. I work all the time and I love science and I've, you know, always been fascinated with science, but I was living in New York City. It was a great city. I had no friends. I mean, I had colleagues in my lab. I knew nobody outside the lab. I only went from my apartment to my apartment to get takeout and then eat it at the lab or in my apartment. I gained 20 pounds because I wasn't moving physically. And I had a wake-up call when I went on a river rafting trip. So I finally got up myself out of the lab, went on a river rafting trip. I was in my 30s at the time. And I realized I was the weakest person on this whole trip. And, you know, there were 65 plus years old guys that were much stronger than me and 16-year-olds on this trip that were stronger than me. I'm like, oh, no, this is terrible. I really need to go to the gym. So that's what got me to the gym. And once I started working out regularly, you know, I got the mood boost. I got a clear mood boost that got me back to the gym. And after really getting established, let's say a year later, that's when I started to notice that my memory, this function that I studied as an expert for the last 15 years at least, seemed to be better. And my attention seemed to be better. And I noticed it when I was writing the grants. I write a lot. And when you write, you really have to focus deeply. Mm-hmm. And you have to, well, for writing grants, you have to remember all sorts of little details from all the different papers that you're reading, synthesizing in this grant. And that seemed to go better. And, you know, I could have just been having a good day, but I linked it to the exercise. And that's what got me initially seriously curious about whether it could be true that my increased regular exercise regime was related to these cognitive changes that I was seeing. And that's really the impetus of the whole rest of the story, which is I have wound down the memory work. I have started to focus on the exercise work. And I want to know, is it marathon running? Is it kickboxing? Is it yoga that is optimal for these different brain functions? And what if you're 18 years old or 30 years old or 40 years old? What is that exercise prescription for different age groups? And what is the minimum amount of the most effective exercise that you can do to get these brain boosts? That's what I want to answer.
So you're basically saying that exercise makes us smarter and helps us in our daily functions, our jobs, whatever that may be. And you're researching, you know, how much and what type and, you know, what stage of life, how far along that road are you to answering some of those questions?
Yeah. So we have two major kind of lines of research in the lab. We're looking at the effects of a single bout of exercise. So what if I just go to the gym for an hour? How much is that going to improve my brain function? We've already published a paper showing that that will significantly improve several different measures of attention. You are paying better attention, or you can pay better attention after this workout compared to if you did the same amount of time watching a video. And that lasts at least 2 hours. It doesn't mean it doesn't last longer, but we didn't look at it longer than 2 hours.
Sure.
But the real question that, or the question that I'm most excited to answer is, what if you go from low or medium fit to significantly higher fit with regular running or whatever you're going to do? What are the long-term benefits of that? And when do those benefits start to come online? So as a shorthand, it has been said that exercise can make you smarter. But I'm being very specific. There are mood improvements. There are decreases in stress that affects all of us. There's significant improvements in memory that have been shown in animal studies, and significant improvements in attention. When does that happen? Which is the question everybody asks me at the end of my talk, and I have to say, wait, well, we're working on it. We're getting to a specific answer. Yeah. So we're in the middle. And it takes a while to get, you know, all the studies and you know, I would love to compare solitary running with perhaps group fitness kinds of situations. Is the social aspect doing part? I mean, you could run in groups. I know, you know, marathon runners, they often train in groups. So there's a group aspect there. But there's lots of interesting things to compare. And I'm just starting to sort through what are the major categories that would be reasonable to look at. I think running is absolutely one of them. It's pure cardio. It's continuous. We're two-thirds through a study that one of my undergraduates initiated looking at the difference between continuous aerobic exercise, running on a treadmill, high-intensity interval training, and walking on a whole range of different things, just acute one bout of each one of those. And what we found is all three of them significantly improve your mood. So that's great.
Yes.
But which one do you think improves your mood the most?
I want to say the high-intensity interval training. I know, that's my guess.
I'm not going to venture a guess.
It's walking.
Wow.
Walking, at least in our preliminary analyses, all of them improve your mood, but walking improves your mood even more. And I suspect it's because both continuous and high intensity interval training, yeah, you get a high, but there's stress associated with it as well. And so that might decrease the mood a little bit or mitigate that. But walking, you get all the benefits. So, you know, it's going to be a really interesting pattern. It's not going to be one size of exercise fits all brain functions. And I think I could already say that mood boost is one of the easiest things to get because you can get it with just one bout of walking. And then we're going to add all these other things on. What is the next, you know, easiest thing to get? What is the next easiest thing to get? And again, does it vary based on your fitness level, your gender, your age? You know, I think those are the questions I'm fascinated with.
How do you measure mood boost? Do you just have the participants on a scale of 1 to 10 rate how they
yeah.
feel?
There are standardized tests that have been very well validated that you can look at mood and anxiety levels. And these same kind of measures have been, there's a whole bunch of apps out there that are doing it in a clever way. So you can monitor kind of online. So really people can start to do their own measurement of mood, which is how I started in these exercise studies. I noticed things in myself. I would test what are the effects of early morning exercise versus after work exercise on my work, how it affects my work. And I noticed that early morning exercise allowed me to have a longer productive work day. And it makes sense because exercise is boosting a whole bunch of growth factors, neurotransmitters. And so if I do that first thing before I get to work, all those neurotransmitters are up and they stay up for an unidentified amount of time, but it keeps me working. Not that after work exercise is bad. I don't want to say that at all. Keep doing your after work exercise if you're doing it. But I do say that it's very interesting to start testing these things out on yourself. You can't publish a paper on that, but it gives you a personal feeling, just like you have personal stats on your running or whatever other exercise that you do. I find that really fascinating.
Can you recommend maybe a questionnaire for runners if they wanted to test this out on themselves? Like, what are some of the ways that they can rate themselves?
Well, you know, I think, somebody showed me a really fun-looking app for mood. And I would just use these simple apps that you can get.
Okay.
It was either
a mood stone might work too.
Mood ring.
Yeah. No, I'm not gonna, you know.
I know you're a scientist. You wouldn't. That, yes. You wouldn't support that.
No, but the apps are a good way to get a start and just do it systematically associated with different times of the day and different levels of runs you might want to do and see what you notice. And that's a good way to start.
Awesome. So I was watching a TED Talk that you did, and you mentioned that you were teaching this class at NYU and you had your students exercise and you had them yell positive affirmations.
Yes.
And they were kind of feeling awkward about that at first.
Yeah, at first. Everybody does.
Sure, I would too, and I like to yell. I never yell at my wife, though.
Okay.
So why does that help, though? Why does yelling a positive affirmation work at all?
So the story was that I, when I started going to the gym, after not going to the gym for a long time, the one class that I loved the most that I would always come back to is this class that combines physical movements from kickbox and dance and yoga with positive spoken affirmations. Mm-hmm. And it's a class called Intensati. It was developed by an amazing fitness instructor in New York named Patricia Moreno. So the philosophy behind the class is that actually declaring something with your voice is more powerful than just thinking it. And by forcing everybody, or we don't force it, encouraging everybody to shout out or declare these positive affirmations for that hour, you are replacing the negative thoughts that might go through your mind at the gym, like, oh my God, they are so much fitter than I am, and they have better clothes, and I feel bad, with all of these positive thoughts. And exercise, as we know, already is a mood booster. But I can tell you that exercise combined with yelling out positive affirmations once you get over the awkwardness is even more empowering. I literally came out of that class, and I felt like $1 million. And so when I decided to teach this undergraduate course about the effects of exercise on the brain, I was just going to go, it was going to be a standard course. I was going to go over the literature, all the studies in rodents, and then go to all the studies in clinical settings. And I thought, well, you know, the whole background or the whole reason why I'm teaching this class is because I got interested in exercising myself. So wouldn't it be fun to bring exercise into the classroom? Mm-hmm. And when my department said, well, there's no extra money to hire an exercise instructor. We pay you to teach the classes. So you can't have any extra money to have an exercise instructor. I decided that I would go and get certified to teach this class, my favorite class, Intensati, and teach it to the students. Mm-hmm. And that started the most extensive preparation for a class that I've ever had in my entire career, because I took teacher training at the gym. I trained for 6 months and practiced for all of my friends and my cat, you know, at home, trying to learn how to, because it's complicated. You have to have the rhythm. You have to learn the affirmations. You have to show the moves and do the affirmations. And it's just a lot of coordination that you have to do. And I was a student, but that's one thing. To lead it is takes a lot of practice. And I had to develop the class. So I did all that in parallel. And I'll never forget another memorable day walking into that first class with the undergraduates the first time I taught it. They knew they had to exercise, so they were in their workout gear. But the unique thing is I walked into this classroom that I'd been teaching in for the previous 15 years. And of course, I was clad head to toe in Lululemon because I was teaching this very different. I usually don't come to university in Lululemon, but that day I did. And I also remember it because, you know, I'm not nervous lecturing to even large groups. I've done it so much. But I'd never taught an exercise class in the university. And I was really nervous because I wanted them to like it as much as I did. And, you know, I was a new teacher and, you know, I was very nervous. Sure. But the most memorable thing was the looks on the faces of the students when they saw me in my Lululemon. They looked so scared. They're like, oh my God, she's going to make us actually exercise.
We might have to sweat.
I know, exactly. I think they were afraid of sweating with their professor. And then I told them that they would have to shout out affirmations. And there's lots of kind of nervous laughter going on. But I'm like, okay, let's do it. And once you, I mean, that's why I love teaching undergrads. They will buy in to this. If you are committed to it, they will be committed to it. And they committed to it. And so we had a great time. And I taught the exercise class. We had a 5-minute meditation. And then we went directly into the lecture. And I can say that the same enthusiasm that I got in sweating with my, you know, with my students really easily flowed into the academic part. And it became this great interactive course, more interactive than I've ever had before. And I say, and this is true, it changed the way that I taught every other course because I have this new model. This is the level of interaction and the level of engagement that I want in both myself and my students. So it was a real game-changing course for me.
So how can someone implement that? I mean, what if they're out running right now listening to this?
Yes, yeah.
Without being committed to a mental institution.
That guy's yelling to himself.
Yeah. I mean, you can whisper good affirmations. I mean, if you run, you're going to be running long stretches with nobody around.
Sure.
And you know, just like in Intensati class, yelling the affirmations actually increases the cardio output of the exercise. So if you run and yell out affirmations like, I am strong, I am committed, I am inspired, and I'm on fire, you know, you have to rhyme a little bit and just repeat those. It's like a mantra. I mean,
that's better than yeah, baby, which is all I could think of.
Okay, that can work. I mean, you know, I get very involved in writing the affirmations. I was very, very worried because once at some point I started writing my own affirmations that I change every month when I teach. And, you know, you have to rhyme. It's like a poem. It's like, I'm a scientist. Nobody taught me how to rhyme. And it's not good enough rhyme. And, you know, but it's actually opened up a whole new thing. And I really do focus on themes in my life and I just got a new space to teach because the old space that I've been teaching in for 6 years got taken over. And it was so devastating to lose that space at NYU, but I got a new space at Lululemon. So the whole series that I'm going to teach on June 6th for the first time is it morphed from, I would add, original affirmations like, I love this room. This room is great. But that wasn't inspiring enough. But it ended up going into the idea of holding space and holding space in your heart for different things, for your dreams, for your family, for the people that are there, the people that are not there. And it's this whole idea of the value of space. It doesn't, not only physical space, which I'll talk about, but also kind of internal space. And so it's like, oh, that, you know, working through all of that was really helpful for me in thinking about how grateful I was and how valuable the perfect space is for doing something like this.
So if a runner wanted to maybe intentionally think about what they wanted to meditate on, a specific mantra for a particular run or a race, and just repeating that out loud over and over would be super beneficial for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It really is. What you think about comes about. I really believe that. And it's certainly true if you think about all the negative things that go through your mind. Oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not tall enough. And you can see in other people how much that can bring them down. And so conversely, if they can switch their thoughts, if we can switch our thoughts to positive thoughts that I believe in myself, I'm strong, I am committed, whatever works for you, and it's very individual, but just the act of thinking about what is that empowering phrase that I need right now and just use that one, it is a very powerful and a small thing that you can do.
I really love that concept because I talk a lot about mantras with my coaching clients, you know, find a good mantra to keep those thoughts positive so that the negative thoughts don't creep in. But I like the fact of saying them out loud.
Yes.
You know, over and over again, that's really powerful.
I've had the experience that people think I'm crazy because I wrote a new series of affirmations, but I still have to memorize them. And sometimes it's hard because they're long. And I was on a plane going to someplace, and I was trying to memorize them. I was like going through them, and the guy next to me said, "Excuse me, are you praying? Are you praying?" And I was like, "No, I'm practicing my positive affirmations. It's okay. We can talk."
And then he's like, "Well, that's even weirder than praying."
He didn't say that out loud, but I bet you he was thinking that.
He's like, "All righty then."
Okay, whatever.
You know what? What I'm liking about this is I have always enjoyed the self-help genre, and a lot of people have criticized it in the past because it's just pop psychology rather than based on more rigorous in scientific and academic studies. But it seems like there's just so much that you're talking about that relates to a lot of things that I've heard about the power of positive thinking, meditation, affirmation. It's just refreshing to me to hear that, you know, here you are a brain scientist and you're speaking of the power of affirmation.
Yeah. And, you know, it is getting definitely much more quantitative in the study. The whole area of positive psychology is science based.
Sure.
And in regular psychology, there's an area of study that fascinates me, which is the area of mindset. What happens when you have a belief? It's just a belief system. And what they're showing is that your beliefs can change your physiology. And so one of my favorite studies is they bring people in and they have them on two different occasions. On the first occasion, they bring them in and they have them drink a milkshake. And they say, "This is Slim Delight. And it tastes good, but it actually has 5 calories. So drink up." And the next time they bring them in and they give them a shake and they say, "This is fluffy and creamy dessert. And it has 700 calories. So drink up. This is a special thing." Of course, they're the same exact thing. And they measure the effect on the hunger hormone ghrelin. Hmm. And what they find is that mindset of whether they believe that it's low calorie or high calorie has a significant effect on how much ghrelin is released. You have much less hunger hormone when you think it's the fatty version than when you think it is the low-fat version. So wow. That shows the power. We're talking about mind-body connection.
Yeah.
Here is a lot of the theme. And so exercise shows how moving your body affects your brain, and that's what my book is about a lot. But these systematic studies of mindset are showing exactly how much your mind can affect physiological properties in your body, which I found fascinating.
I do too. I mean, the placebo effect is endlessly fascinating to me too.
Yes, exactly.
So I was going to ask you, have there been studies done that have found like exactly what is happening in the brain when someone's thinking negative?
I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with any
studies. To your knowledge, there's not any like brain damage happening because of negative thinking.
No, I don't think it would be brain damage. It would be particular circuits that get emphasized that are associated with these negative thoughts. And you know, anything that's practiced a lot, you practice a visual perceptual task and that circuit gets strengthened. So your brain is a combination of what you're practicing in it. So if you practice a lot of negative thoughts, those circuits will be strong. If you practice a lot of positive thoughts, those circuits will be stronger. Mm-hmm. I'm more familiar with the studies that are looking at maternal and romantic love and those very positive emotions. And a lot of that is activating the reward circuits and the affiliative behavior circuits. But I'm not familiar with negative thought studies.
Well, I thought I'd throw it out there. We were going to ask you about, because there's a chapter in the book called Making Your Brain Smile. And you talk about the reward system. So maybe you can get into that a little bit here about our brain's reward system.
Yeah. So we're learning more and more about the reward system. And basically, everybody knows what makes their brain smile. Whatever, you know, you love. I love watermelon, especially in summertime.
we had some last night.
Oh, right. I love watermelon. I love, you know, good food. I'm a real foodie. So everybody has a list like that. And mine usually involve food, but other people's might include other things like running or you know, things that really that you just love to do. And that feeling that comes with whatever, you know, chocolate is usually one that people can really relate to. That feeling that happens right after you get the chocolate, or even as you anticipate the chocolate, because that sometimes is when the brain is most in its positive state. Hmm. That is because of this reward circuit that's going. And so the point of the book is the idea of paying attention, not only understanding what brain areas are involved that include the dopamine system and basically the release of dopamine is associated with this feeling of reward, but understanding the range of things that can activate it. And I start with things that are obvious. You know better than anybody what activates it. But some things that you might not realize activate the reward system include altruism. So giving to others, which sometimes may not make it on the list. Some people, it is on the list. But I love reading the studies showing that giving to others can be as rewarding as, you know, winning the lottery. And sometimes even more rewarding. And so that's a very easy way to get that system going on a regular basis. And also a reminder in that chapter that drugs of abuse are playing with this system, because the drugs of abuse can actually activate that system in a very artificial way and get you that high that's why you'll do anything to get that drug again. And it is in a diabolical way, you know, playing with the brain's reward system. So there's kind of a warning note and a positive note and information that you might not realize in terms of altruism that can get the happiness going in your brain.
So drugs obviously are a bad way to activate one's reward system. Are there some good ways? Are there some hacks that we can hack our reward system that are healthy?
Actually, my favorite one is exercise. So aerobic exercise, we know, can activate the dopamine system. And in fact, one of the first exercise studies that I did was looking at the effects of exercise in a population of recovering elderly drug addicts at the Odyssey House here in New York City. And the idea is, you know, we got hooked up with the Odyssey House because they have run a program for the last 20 years or so called Run for Your Life. This CEO of that company was a former drug addict and got himself out of the habit by marathon running. Hmm. So everybody has the option in that facility to train for the New York City Marathon, which is a huge thing. And they use that as a therapy because it's activating dopamine, just like the drugs do, to help wean people off the dopamine. It's not an official program, but more and more studies are starting to look at how exercise can be used as a way to help people recover from drugs, because it gives you a little bit of dopamine boost and can help you decrease the cravings for the drugs.
Yeah, I agree. I've told lots of people who wanted to quit smoking.
Yeah.
To start running.
Right.
You look at cigarettes differently after that.
Two incompatible activities.
Well, we have one more question, Angie. You want to ask about the stress question, number six?
Yeah, we've talked a little bit here about how exercise helps protect against stress. And I know many people who exercise and run, that's one of the primary reasons, is
yes,
for that stress relief. You know, talk about that, kind of dive into that a little bit here.
Sure. So one of the brain structures that is most sensitive to stress hormones is our friend, the hippocampus. There are many, many stress receptors for cortisol, the stress hormone, on the hippocampus. And we know that people that suffer from long-term stress, people with PTSD, their hippocampi are actually shrunk, because long-term stress can actually kill cells in the hippocampus. So what is exercise doing? Well, on one hand, exercise is helping to build new neurons in the hippocampus, so maybe counteracting all that stress around. And it also decreases the stress response itself. So you're kind of addressing it at two different levels. So it's a free way to get immediate stress relief and long-term buildup of the structure that you want to protect from stress as you go on. You know, people, this gets even more debilitating as you get older because you have less of a ability to kind of reverse that hippocampal damage. So this is also one of my personal motivations for regular exercise. I want to have as least stress in my life and the largest number of hippocampal cells. And so I don't want to negate all of my exercise by killing more cells with stress.
Right.
And so I'm always keeping a running count of my hippocampal cells in my brain. Most people, I don't do that, I realize. But,
well, you
but
can actually count that?
You know, on a metaphorical level. I'm
counting my hippocampal cells. That'd be an amazing app to develop, though.
It would. I love
that.
Scan your hippocampus.
So for the person who feels like they're one of the excuses that they don't exercise is they are too stressed out and they don't have enough time. Oh, well, that is like maybe a double-edged sword there, because not only they have the negative effects of stress, so they're not offsetting it with exercise.
Right.
So probably a good reason just to really reevaluate, you know, your life like you had to at one point, and realize
yes,
all I do is work and that's not sustainable long-term.
Right. And what I like to tell people is that, you know, I hear this and I use this excuse myself. I'm so busy as a neuroscientist, I can't do that. But what I found after going through and exploring and doing all these experiments is that hour to 2 hours that I spend, you have to go to the gym, you change or whatever you're going to do, that time that I spend away from work makes the time that I'm at work significantly more effective. I'm more productive. And that's what people need to understand. So it's not the case that you don't have time to exercise. You don't have time not to exercise. I mean, that's how I've come to think about it. And I wish there was a better way that I could come up with to illustrate that. I mean, I tell my story, and that was one of the themes for one of the TED Talks that I gave. But it's absolutely true. And I know that it feels good to feel like if I work 24/7, that is the maximum productivity that I could ever achieve. And I'm here to say that that is not the case. Your brain needs more than just constant work and constant focus. It needs to relax. It needs, we didn't even talk about meditation, which to talk about in the book, which also is very good for your brain. And I live on a combination and a healthy balance of exercise, meditation, work. And in a sense, I work and I do my work so I could enjoy my exercise and my meditation is how my mindset and how I kind of try and approach it. And I encourage other people to do that as well.
Well, that's really good, because a lot of times when I'm out there running or exercising, I think about all the stuff I need to be doing in my work, and I can't get my mind off work, and I just want to long to get back and start cranking out more work.
Yeah.
Instead of just seeing it, well, this exercise, enjoy it because it's going to give me more focus when I get back to work. Let's not worry about that right now. Have you found that struggle at all?
I'll tell you my secret. So there's a line or there's a subchapter in the book that's called Confessions of a Yo-Yo Meditator. So I tried all kinds of meditation. It would work for a while and then I didn't want to do it and I wasn't regular until I found, and this isn't in the book because I discovered this after I published the book. I found a daily meditation practice that I just love, and it's a tea meditation that I learned from a tea expert. He's a monk, and he runs a tea institute in Taiwan. And so it's simply drinking tea, brewing and drinking tea in silence. And it helped that I met the guy. He was a guest at a hotel I was staying in Bali. And we did this tea meditation every morning. And we were in Bali. And it was so beautiful. We were outside. And he would brew this really, really delicious living tea from special tea farms in China. And I thought, I love this practice. And literally almost every day, except for travel days, I have done this at home first thing in the morning. And you think, oh, well, you just start worrying about how many emails that you didn't answer. And instead, what comes up so much is just what I'm grateful for. So what you might want to do is either try the tea meditation or in the running, instead of worrying about that, just think about what you're grateful for that you notice. Because I find that sometimes it passes too fast. And then during the meditation, I realize, wow, that was something that was such a gift to me. And I take that time to really appreciate that and think through it and realize, you know, basically everything, we all have more things that we should be grateful for than I think than we give that gratitude to. So I spend the time doing that, and that has kept me focused and kept the emails out of my meditation, which is good.
So you do that every morning. How many minutes do you take to do that?
You know, I don't count it in minutes. I count it in cups of tea. And so I do 3 during the weekdays and 3 or 5 on the weekends. And it takes between, I don't know, half an hour because I have to boil the water, half an hour and 45 minutes. But I enjoy the longer time that I get on the weekend to do it, which really tells me, okay, I'm in this meditation. This is one that's going to stick.
Well, it sounds like one of the benefits of meditation is making that margin in your life for gratitude and thanksgiving.
Yes.
And instead of just rushing from one task to the other,
right,
getting this frantic, you know, type life that we often have is making that margin for gratitude in whatever form that it takes, you know, whether it's tea meditation or prayer or whatever people, you know, find that works for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brewing coffee and checking email?
No.
No, sorry.
All right.
Maybe you could do a coffee meditation, but you'd have to limit the email. I don't know.
Well, this has been great. One final question. The brain is such an amazing organ, I should say. How come there's so many people that don't seem to be using theirs very well?
But they are. That's the thing. They are using it. And there's so many different ways to use it. And part of it is a choice. And you can use it to have negative thoughts, check your email all the time. Or you can use it in a way that brings more gratitude and more peace and a stronger brain in your life. And so it's all a choice.
So where would people need to go online if they wanted to find out more about you and about the book?
So I have a website, www.wendysuzuki.com, and you can find out everything there from my lab. Everything about my lab is there. Everything about the book is there, where you can buy it, quick links to buy the book, and also about my public speaking. And if you want to watch my TED Talks, all 4 of them are there, and lots of other interviews. So lots of fun stuff there.
Nice. Well, it's been a real joy talking to you, Dr. Suzuki. You have amazing energy, and it's been very uplifting to talk to you.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Have a great weekend. We appreciate it. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Wendy Suzuki. You'll find links to her website and book and everything that we mentioned over on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com, when you look for the show notes to this episode. And this would be a good time to thank Jabra. They make the Sport Pulse, which is a wireless pair of earbuds with in-ear heart rate monitor. And I've owned a pair of Jabras now for a little while, and I've put a lot of miles on them. They've worked great. They're adjustable, so they stay in your ears. I have the hardest time with having earbuds, like the ones that you get from Apple, just the plain earbuds.
You have weird ears.
They don't stay in my ears.
You would run marathons with black electrical tape, taping your headphones into your ears.
Yes.
It was a little bit embarrassing. So thankfully, the Jabra Sport Pulse came along and saved us from that misery.
And they also come with a running app so that you can adjust the settings and track your progress. And this is the last episode that Jabra is sponsoring here. We've agreed to a certain amount. So if you haven't headed over to their website yet to sign up for their newsletter, be sure to do that because you'll get special offers and discounts, and they've even been doing giveaways and promotions. Just go to jabra.com/MTA. That's jabra.com/MTA. We also like to thank our other sponsor for this episode, Mio Global. They are makers of the most precise heart rate monitors that you can wear on your wrist, so you can ditch the chest straps without losing accuracy. I've been testing out the fitness tracker they sent me, and it's nice to be able to see the amount of steps that you take in a day. I know, Angie, like, you try to get to 10,000 steps in a day or something, right?
At least, yeah.
Well, we spent all day driving, and I had my Mio on, and I think it took, like, 675 steps. But it's so cool to be able to track progress, and Mio makes it easy.
Plus, you can get your heart rate there, and you can use it as a watch as well because it features the time. So all that good data right on your wrist in a very comfortable band.
So if you're looking for a fitness tracker, their popular Mio Fuse will track your daily activities such as sleep, steps, distance, and calories burned. And they're putting together a great deal for our listeners. If you go to mioglobal.com/MTA, use the promo code MTA15 during checkout, and you can save 15% on any Mio product. Once again, that's Mio Global, mioglobal.com/MTA, and use the code MTA15 to save 15% on any Mio product. Well, usually we chit-chat about what's going on in our life. You know, we don't take a whole lot of time to do that because we try not to be very self-absorbed, right?
Try not to bore people with all the gory details.
But usually we chit-chat in the beginning of the podcast. But we wanted to give you an update about our epic summer conquest, which I've dubbed it, which Angie always rolls her eyes. Anytime I say the word epic, I think you roll your eyes.
Especially.
Which makes me want to say it more.
Combined with conquest.
Well, we have a 25-foot bunkhouse camper trailer that is a conquest. That's the model camper that we have. And so it was just so fitting. And the goal is to travel to some and see some amazing things and make some amazing memories for our kids. But I think the best way to kick off our conversation about how our summer conquest is going so far, because we're 10 days into it now.
11.
11 days, that's right. Is maybe we'll just check on Angie's sanity level. So Angie, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you think your sanity is holding up?
Right now, pretty good, because the kids are outside playing. And I have just run a beautiful race.
Yes.
So I'm feeling all the happy endorphins flowing through my body. Now, about 4 days into our trip, it had basically been raining every single day. And the children and us were feeling very cooped up inside. Plus, the hot water was not working in the camper. So it had been 4 days without a hot shower. And I think I would have paid $1,000 for a bathtub, a good night's sleep, and 24 hours of quiet. Those were all I asked.
Wow. But things began to improve gradually, right?
I would say there are highs and lows, much like a roller coaster. Being stuck in the car all day with the kids fighting, getting to a campsite late, and having to get everything set up and everyone settled down, that's kind of a low. Now, the days that we get to do something like hike in the Grand Canyon, or, you know, we're anticipating going to Yosemite, or have a more relaxed schedule. Those are the better days.
See, I'm pretty good at just blocking out all the downside, all the negative. The difference between your personality and mine, because it's still worth it to me to have the experience and to say that we went, it's all worth it.
Yeah, there have been a lot of positive things. We've got to see some beautiful things, run in some amazing spots so far.
Let's talk about some of the cool things we've done so far. Like Angie mentioned, it was really hot in our neck of the woods. We live in southeast Missouri, and it was just starting to get really humid. So we escaped out of there as fast as we could and traveled across Oklahoma. And then when we got into New Mexico and Arizona, it was still hot, but it was a different kind of heat. It was a dry heat. So it was more welcome to me because I'd rather have the dry heat than the humidity, personally.
Yeah, I can stand that a lot easier, too. Just stay hydrated and stay out of the sun during the worst hours of the day.
But we were rolling across the desert and across stretches of I-40 here in the States, and it was over 100 degrees.
Oh, yeah.
And then we're staying at RV parks, and we found this little park in Arizona, close to the California border. And we got there at night and we left in the morning, but I was talking to the guy that ran the place and he said, it's going to get up to 115 today.
Wow. And it was just barren, like sand, some, kind of low shrubs that obviously get the moisture and cacti.
Yes.
But it was really cool. I got to go for a run that morning. There was kind of these old ATV trails. There was, I guess, state land surrounding the RV park. And there was just like this kind of little mountain out in the distance. And I was able to like run almost to the foot of it and back. It was just like right through the desert.
Yeah. I'm glad you got that run in. That also helps. If we can both get our runs in before we start traveling, that really does help.
Definitely.
We went to the Grand Canyon. First time you'd been there, right?
Yes.
And of course, first time for our kids. So we did the little rim hike, just a little day hike. It was really hot and our kids didn't want to do any hiking. So we kind of drug them along, and I don't know if they liked it too much, but they went.
They did. And I'm looking forward to the days when their legs are longer and can do more.
Yes.
Or
it was a little outside their comfort zone.
Yeah, or you and I will just have to go back and by ourselves and do like the rim to rim.
Yeah, that's right. We were looking down in the Grand Canyon, and we've heard about these runners that do rim to rim, and I think it's like 21 miles from rim to rim, and down at the bottom of the canyon at Phantom Ranch for that day. It was going to be over 100 degrees. It was going to be crazy hot down there. So definitely when we go do this rim-to-rim run, we're not going to do it in June.
Right. Smart thinking.
But yeah, that'll be awesome. We made our way to Southern California. We stayed in Anaheim for a couple of days. I took the kids to Disneyland. And then we went to Huntington Beach. And
the kids swam in the freezing cold water.
Yeah, it was cold, but they got in and they loved it. And I got in with them.
The weather was really unseasonably cool the whole time we were there, too. I mean, I don't think it got over 70 degrees. So from a running standpoint, that's great. From a swimming standpoint, not so much.
But the waves were awesome, though. I don't think they had never been in waves that big.
Right.
And experienced the sensation of having a wave toss you around like a rag doll. I love it. And then we drove up to the Silicon Valley because we had the opportunity to visit the Google campus, something I've been wanting to do for a long time. We have a Academy member named Noor Ali Hassan, who we've actually interviewed on the podcast before. We did a two-part series about how busy people find time to train, and she was featured in that series. And she works there at Google and invited us to get a tour of the campus and have lunch at one of their many cafeterias. So that was amazing. And I just got to say that the Googleplex, which is what they call their campus, is huge, and you can walk for miles and not see it all.
It is. It was way larger than I imagined, and very nice, too. Just a beautiful campus, and they're doing a lot right there.
Yeah, the company culture is cool, as probably a lot of you have read about. So many little fun things to see and do. And with like sand volleyball courts and sleeping pods and all this amazing food trucks that drive up and park, they're on campus and all this stuff. I asked Norm, like, does anybody ever do any work around here? She says, oh yeah, people are workers and they're all self-actualized, to make a reference to Maslow and his hierarchy of needs. Definitely brought people up to the apex of the pyramid there, Angie.
That's
and
right.
Human productivity. Kind of like MTA in our company culture is amazing here, too.
Not in the last 11 days, it hasn't been. My basic hierarchy of human needs has not been reached.
Yes. We have two employees, myself and Angie. And then, of course, we made our way to the 50K that Angie ran just today that we're going to be telling you about in our next episode. In the next couple of days, we're going to be going into Yosemite National Park and doing some hikes with our kids. But they're having a good time. I'm having a good time. Angie's sort of having a good time. She had a good time today running. Right, Angie?
Yes, I did.
So that is an update for you there, folks, on our summer adventure, spending 2 months in a camper, traveling the American West, seeing some amazing places. If you want to follow along with our journey, you can do that on Instagram. We have an Instagram account, Marathon Academy. And If you want more training resources and help with your running journey, go to marathontrainingacademy.com. Thanks once again to Mio Global, makers of the world's most precise heart rate monitors for your wrist so you can get the most out of your training. Don't forget to go to mioglobal.com/MTA and use the code MTA15 to save 15%. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. And once again, we want to remind you that you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Right on my way, right on my way.